Welcome to the LDN Radio Show, brought to you by the LDN Research Trust. I'm your host, Linda Elsiegood. I have an exciting lineup of guest speakers who are LDN experts in their field. We will be discussing low-dose naltrexone and its many uses in autoimmune diseases, cancers, etc. Thank you for joining us. This show is sponsored by Alcohol Recovery Scotland, helping individuals break free from alcohol addiction using the Sinclair Method, TSM, in Scotland. Contact them through their website at www.alcoholrecoveryscotland.co.uk. Welcome to the show. This week, we're not going to be talking about low-dose naltrexone. We're going to be talking about full-dose naltrexone in 50 milligram tablets, which is used for alcohol use disorder, using the Sinclair method. And today my guest is Bruce Rose from Alcohol Recovery Scotland. Thank you for joining us today, Bruce.
No problem at all. Nice to be here.
Can you tell our listeners about the Sinclair method, first of all?
Yeah, the Sinclair method, as you were saying, it includes using 50 milligrams of naltrexone. And the simple way to describe it is it's an alcohol reduction program leading to either safe drinking or down to abstinence completely, where clients will use 50 milligrams of naltrexone alongside alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's probably the simplest way to explain it.
And can you tell us how you came about to set up this alcohol recovery in Scotland?
Yeah, my background for a number of years was in management of alcohol and drug rehab centres. I'm actually based up in the Highlands of Scotland, and I moved up to the Highlands of Scotland to manage an alcohol and drug rehab centre. Here in the UK at the moment, especially in Scotland, funding is so difficult to get hold of. To run a rehab centre at the moment, you're probably looking at, you're not getting any change from about £500,000 a year to run a rehab. Wow. And the cost of it was just, it was just impossible to get your hands on. So the rehab that I was working at initially was privately funded, and they basically ran out of funds. They couldn't keep the rehab going on a long period. So I just started looking around on the internet. I started looking around, and I thought there must be a cheaper... It was difficult to get the cheaper model with a successful model, which was the battle. Mm-hmm. So I looked around, and I searched the internet and searched the internet. And eventually came across a video that was talking about the Sinclair method and how people could work with alcohol issues from the comfort of their own home simply by using a medication and a support program that came with it. I have to be honest, when I first heard about it and I first saw it, my whole background was abstinence-based. It was stop drinking, grab hold of the nearest chair and hope that you're still in recovery in 3 to 4 years' time.
Can I just ask you there, how successful was the program you were using at that time? I mean, were people able to come off alcohol? And if so, did they stay off? Did they relapse? What would you have said the success rate was?
In the rehab centres?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It was difficult to judge it on a long-term basis because obviously once clients left, you didn't really see them much. When they were with us, actually in the centre, you were probably quite high. I would estimate about the sort of 60% mark, 60 to 70% mark. Mm-hmm. But that's whilst they were in a very controlled environment. They would be tested on a regular basis. The challenge came was when they left. Naltrexone works, without going into too many some medical details about the whole thing. It reverses the process of addiction and takes away the craving that people have. So the challenge that you had, we had in the rehab centres was when people left, the craving was still there, the addictive side of the alcohol was still there. And all it took was a life situation, some sort of issue that happened in life. And then people would then relapse and then they were back into the whole cycle again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think long term, I've seen different figures. They reckon that long term, 3 to 5 years, you're probably looking at about 7 to 10% success rate.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, not great.
No.
And then when I saw the Sinclair method, they were saying that it was a 78% success rate, which, to be honest with you, that's why I then looked at it and I thought, no, that's just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I did some research. I spoke to lots of different people. They were claiming there was 120 clinical trials done. I spoke to Claudia Christian in America. I saw a lot of the reports. I saw some there's a book called The Cure for Alcoholism. There's a lot of medical information in there. And the more I looked at it, I spoke to some people, different places who were using the program already. And it all seemed to stack up. And I thought, this is crazy. This looks like it will work. So that then led me to leaving the rehab center. I never want to knock at the rehab centers because they do a lot of good work for the people that it works for.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just not one size doesn't fit all in the recovery world. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I have interviewed some people who have used this method and have managed to come off of alcohol. So could you tell us how your experience has been with helping people with the Sinclair method?
Yeah, it's been a learning process from the start. So at the moment in Scotland, I believe I'm the only person that's doing it in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a doctor that I work with in Edinburgh who does all the prescribing and all the medical work for me.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it was initially, it wasn't trial and error as in the medication and all that stuff. That was all medically looked after. The trial and error came in the support programs. We ask people for drink diaries. We phone them on a weekly basis once they've got into the program. There's lots of different suggestions that we make for people to change habits, to change processes. So we've been learning a lot as we've been going along with the whole process. So initially, I would guess we were probably having about a 50% success rate. But with the things that I've been learning from it recently, the success rate has now gone up. And I would say it's probably around about, I would have to go back and check my figures, but we're probably about 65 to 70% success at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you take the 50 milligram tablet before you start drinking alcohol, which then...
Yep.
Doesn't affect you. You don't get any high or a buzz from the alcohol. You just stay exactly the same as you did before you started drinking, which then decreases that desire because it doesn't give you what you're looking for from the alcohol. How long before you start drinking do you have to take the 50 milligram tablet?
They take it 1 hour before they drink.
Mm-hmm.
So we always recommend people to take a pill 1 hour before you drink, and then people will then consume alcohol after the hour is gone. And that just gives them an hour to get into the system and to allow it to get to work properly.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, people, they initially start off, we're seeing in the first, I was checking some figures this morning, in the first 3 to 4 weeks, we're seeing about a 40 to 50% drop in individuals' alcohol intake in the first 3 to 4 weeks. And that seems to be a very regular pattern with people that we have on the program. And then from then, it tends to level out for a few weeks, and then it drops a little bit. We ask people to send us a graph every week, or figures, which then correlates into a graph. Now, that graph will give us a very clear picture from a week-to-week basis on where people are at. So what we find is people will drop a little bit, they might increase a little bit the next week, and then they'll drop a bit more. But the average, as the weeks and the months go on, it definitely just drops and drops and drops and drops. Mm-hmm. As long as people are compliant with taking the medication.
Yes, yes. If you don't take it, it doesn't work, does it?
I mean, yeah.
I interviewed one gentleman who said that, you know, he would open a bottle or a can of beer, I can't remember. And once he'd opened the first one, he would have the second, the third, and so on. He couldn't stop drinking. And yeah. He was taking the 50 milligram tablet, and the number of beers he had started to reduce until he got to the stage where he opened it and he actually put it down and went and did other things. Yeah. You know, he didn't have to drink it all in one go. And that came as quite as a surprise to him, that he could walk away from it. He didn't, you know, have to drink it. And then the desire to drink every day started to go, because there was no reason for it. And he started doing other things. So it is altering your lifestyle, as you were saying, alongside of taking it, to fill the gap of what you would normally be doing.
Absolutely, yeah. We have a big discussion that we have with people, and we always talk about the difference between addiction and craving versus habit. Now, what the naltrexone does is it starts to work, without going into too many details, without the time, it breaks down the neurological pathways and works as an opiate blocker.
Mm-hmm.
So it stops the release of the endorphins, which is what people are addicted to, that the pleasure and the reward that the brain gets from that. So the medication deals with the craving and the addiction side of it. And then you have the habit. So I have a lot of people that have been on the medication for 2 or 3 months, but the alcohol levels sometimes haven't dropped as much as they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So by that stage, I'm then starting to talk to people and counsel people and say, okay, at this stage, the medication is starting to do the work that it needs to do. But what we need to look at now is the habit. So instead of coming in home and just opening up a bottle of wine, take the dog for a walk for a couple of hours, or just change the lifestyle or the habit, the routine that you do. And I've had a number of occasions where people have they've come home, they've changed the plan when they come home, they've gone out for a walk, they've done something else. And then by the time they get home, they then realize, or they're starting to understand then, that the medication has done the job. So they're not craving the alcohol at night, which is what they're used to.
Mm-hmm.
They're just starting to do it out of habit. So they think, oh, and they fill me up the next day and say, oh, I could stop now. I said, no. we've got to do this slowly and surely, so the whole process works properly.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. It's definitely there's two sides to it. There's craving, addiction versus the habit. And we slowly separate the two of them as time goes on. But the medication tends to do the craving. The main difference I'm finding here compared to the abstinence side of things is that the medication stops the long-term craving, and it's the long-term craving that creates the relapses in a normal recovery program.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can stop the craving once somebody has stopped the drinking, then you don't, or you can reduce the relapses by a huge percent, huge percentage, and that's the crucial part to it.
And a number of people who have told me, oh, I have to have a glass of wine in the evening, stroke beer, stroke whiskey, whatever it may be, after a busy day, because it helps relax me.
Yeah.
So that thought pattern has to change, you know, that you don't need alcohol to relax. But of course, it's very easy when you are not addicted to it to see that. But it's not always easy to see it if you do have a problem, because I'm sure until you get to the stage where you want to ask for help, you've had the problem for quite a while. And if people were to suggest you had a problem with alcohol, people would say, no, I don't. I don't have a problem. Yeah. So, you know, the people that come to you, how long would you say they've had a problem with alcohol?
It can vary from just a few months up to 10 years, 10, 15 years.
Mm.
What I am finding at the moment is that most wine is the big issue that I've got at the moment. I would say that 75 to 80% of my clients at the moment are wine-based. It's becoming a huge epidemic in this country. And we use the word, the words alcohol use disorder rather than alcoholism. Because when people mention the word alcoholism, they think of someone who is what I would classify as a chronic drinker, someone who's drinking a bottle of vodka a day or that kind of level.
Mm-hmm.
Most people that I speak to, they're not, I was about to use a Scottish word called stoting, a Scottish word. They're not staggering around the place at nighttime. They're coming home, they're having a glass of wine before the meal, they're having a glass of wine with the meal, and they're finishing off a bottle later on at night.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing it on a day-to-day basis. But the main crux that every single one of them is telling me is that I'm not in control, Bruce. This could quite easily turn into two or three bottles in a nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole life and the whole thinking and the whole structure to what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, that they're going out to work. Like, I've got to get to the supermarket before, it's 10 o'clock here in Scotland. You're not allowed to buy alcohol after 10. I've got to get to the supermarket in time. The whole day and the whole routine is all structured around when can I get my drink and when can I buy the wine. So it's anything from just a few months. The main thing as well that they're saying is that the on-off button for the control of how much they drink doesn't work anymore.
Mm.
That's the main thing that I'm hearing as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about binge drinking? I mean, we used to hear a lot about binge drinking a few years ago, where youngsters would not drink during the week, but then just drink as though it's going out of fashion at the weekends.
Yeah.
I mean, I've worked with youngsters who think that by doing that, because they don't drink during the week, they're not going to become addicted.
Yeah. It's there's two different ways of getting to that level, where some people will start out just by doing that. They won't drink during the week, and then they'll binge at the weekend. And then what then happens is they binge on the Friday, Saturday, and then the binge then turns into Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Okay.
And then it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then it builds that way.
Mm-hmm.
Or what happens quite often, we would see it with guys in the rehab centres, they would come in, they would go for periods of absence, like they'd have a month or 2 months or 3 months. They'd already reached a stage of addiction with the alcohol. So then what they would do is they would stop drinking, they would have a month off drink or 2 months or 3 months. But then what's actually being called the alcohol deprivation principle kicks in. So the longer they're off the drink, the more the craving builds and builds and builds. And eventually they give into it, they have one drink, and there's such a big reward after the deprivation principle has built that people then will actually drink at a higher level than when they did before.
Wow.
So it tends to build and build and build. So binge drinking is probably when people are young and they go out on a Friday night, and that's how it can start. But once people are established drinkers, if you're an established drinker and you're drinking a lot, you hear a lot about Dry January and things like that. There'll be different schools of thought on it, but from the people I've worked with, it's not a good concept, because the craving builds and builds and builds all the way through January, and then at the end of the month, they've had no drink all of January, so they've drunk twice as much at the weekend, or the first weekend, and then they go, oh, I've drunk far too much, so they stop for another month. But then what you're doing is you're creating a binge drinker, which is actually worse for your system, worse for your body. So it's trying to get people to reduce the drinking and then just try and spread it out a little bit more rather than just a big bang of alcohol in the system and then nothing again for them.
For the period. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have children or grandchildren, and the worry is that when they are not school children anymore, you know, or even some school children, unfortunately, experiment with alcohol. What can we do? It is, like you were saying, buying alcohol from supermarkets. It's so easy to get alcohol. I mean, on cigarettes, there's warnings. There is nothing on alcohol, and it's relatively easy to get hold of. I mean, many children find where their parents keep their alcohol. What can we do to try and keep our children safe from becoming addicted to alcohol?
That's probably one of the hardest questions out there at the moment. It's a little bit like where cigarettes was, I don't know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. There's a lot of education that's needed that needs, children need to be taught and made aware of the dangers of alcohol, but then you've then got the other side of it where it's so socially acceptable that the parents are drinking and the friends and the families and everybody's drinking, so the kids are all looking at the parents doing it all and the adults doing it all. So it's a big, I personally think it needs a huge intervention like they did with the cigarettes, where they very slowly start to reduce adverts and they reduce this and reduce that. In the workplace, we're starting to notice there's a lot more drink awareness campaigns that are going into the workplaces to speak to people, which is the start. It doesn't stop the problem, but it's going in and it's actually making a start and making people aware of how much they're drinking and what's dangerous and what's not dangerous. I don't want to take the pleasure away from it. There is a social side to it, but there's also a very dangerous side to it.
I must admit, when we go out, my husband will have a bottle of alcohol-free beer. He says it tastes as good and it doesn't give him a headache. He has a beer probably once a month or something, but he does like this zero alcohol beer. But that's the other thing, isn't it, is peer pressure. If you're out with friends and they're all drinking beer, you'll probably feel uncomfortable drinking a Coke or something. But if you can have an alcohol-free beer, that might be the way to go, do you think? And do they have alcohol-free wine? I think they have types of wine that is alcohol-free. I mean, do you think bringing those kind of products to the market will help with the problem?
Absolutely, because it's just another, it's one of these areas, I think, where in Scotland they've introduced and they've increased the price of some of the cheaper alcohols that you can buy in the supermarket and in the shops. So a lot of people are saying, well, is that solving the problem? But most people are expecting that one issue to solve the whole thing. But I think it's a much bigger picture. So there needs to be a lot more alcohol-free drinks on the market in bars and pubs and places where people can go and have an alcohol drink, alcohol-free drink, as well as the drink-aware stuff, as well as education for children, as well as... I was looking at some figures this morning and it was showing that... I can't remember the dates, but years ago, most of the drinking was done in pubs and most of the drinking was done was beer. It was all beer. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, the majority of drinking is actually done at home and it's wine. Mm-hmm. So the whole culture has changed. So we need to target the wine is the number of of I've got the but the number of women that I'm speaking to at the moment who are saying it is so sociably acceptable amongst their friends and just to go around to the house and open up a bottle of wine, and whereas if you go around and have four or five cans of beer or anything else, it's slightly frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, again, it's just another cultural thing that needs to be changed.
And of course they had, when my children were younger, these Alco pop drinks.
Alco pops, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where you would think it was a soft drink, but it was got vodka in it or something. But going out with friends and having a good time and laughing and joking, you don't need the alcohol to be able to do that. You can still have a good time without it. So,
absolutely, yeah.
I think would you say youngsters are more aware now than they were? I mean, what age group would you say are the biggest drinkers?
I would say I worked in the field when I was in Edinburgh in the central belt of Scotland for a while. And there was a very, very distinct gap from 35 years of age upwards. So 35 years upwards was all alcohol. Everyone you spoke to that 35 years and plus, that all they did was that they drank alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Under 35, now I'm slightly different up here in the Highlands, I can come on to that in a second, but I would say the most of the rest of Scotland, under 35s is drugs. So the drug area is hitting the young, the drug sector is the real epidemic amongst the young ones at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Up here in the Highlands, there's such a drinking culture up here that you find that under 35-year-olds drink and take drugs. But cocaine, there's a horse tranquilizer called ketamine that's on the market at the moment, that is very, very common amongst children at the moment. So it's a difficult. They still drink. They're still aware of the drink, but the drug side of things is becoming huge amongst the young ones.
Mm.
And that's the next area we need to watch out for, unfortunately.
Scary, isn't it? But you were saying about charts and graphs and things. Dr. Jill Cattell did a very good presentation on LDN, or naltrexone for alcohol use disorder. And you can watch that video. She did it for our 2017 conference. If you go to our YouTube channel and put Dr. Jill Cattell, alcohol use disorder, you'll find it. It's also on our YouTube channel. And Dr. Jill Cattell also got us to add extra things to our LDN app to be able to monitor patients that were taking for alcohol use disorder. So it's free. The app is free. If you go to ldnapp.org, you'd be able to download that, and you can put in there your alcohol intake, and then you can print out graphs and charts. So once you've got the app, which can be used on an iPhone, an Android, a PC, a Mac, and whichever device you log into, they sync automatically. So you only have to go in it and put how many units or what, however you measure in your alcohol in there.
Yep.
And it does wonderful things. It shows you over a period of time. So if anybody's interested in that, it's free, and you can download that from LDN.
And just on that as well, it's amazing the motivation and the encouragement it gives people just to see. They've never, as most people I've worked with, have never noted how much they drink on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
So just to see that on paper, on a graph, or on some format,
yes,
is great. And then to see it reduce as well,
yep,
is a very, very good encouragement process.
Exactly. It's like you say, it boosts your confidence that you're actually doing something, and it's that feel-good factor, isn't it, that, you know, I'm making a change. But I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I would say it's been amazing talking to you, and I'm sure...
No, thank you very much.
I'm sure people will have learnt a lot, even though, as I say, it wasn't low-dose naltrexone, but it is something where I'm sure everybody has been touched by somebody who may have an alcohol issue. So really, thank you very much for being my guest today, Bruce.
No, thank you for having me. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. This show is sponsored by Alcohol Recovery Scotland, helping individuals break free from alcohol addiction using the Sinclair Method, TSM in Scotland. Contact them through their website at www.alcoholrecoveryscotland.co.uk. Any questions or comments you may have, please email me, Linda, Linda, at ldnrt.org. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciated your company. Until next time, stay safe and keep well.